than a gaggle of geese. More fun than a room full of wombats. Able to reach huge audiences with a single broadcast. Yes, it's the Outdoor Journal Radio Show. And now, another exciting episode in the adventures of Outdoor Journal Radio.
Well, hello there and welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us. I'm Angelo Viola. He is Peter Bowman.
Hi there.
And this is Outdoor Journal Radio Podcast.
Yeah.
Come on now.
Not to be confused with Outdoor Journal Radio, which is in the past. This is now podcast.
Or Outdoor Journal Television, which is in the past.
Whoa.
Like way past.
Like you're going way back now.
I was listening to that intro. Do you, if I gave you a goose call right now, do you think how long would it take you to learn and call a goose in, do you think?
Hell, what kind of a question is that?
Well, because you hear this geese, so you know what geese sound like. We have geese on the on our intro.
I'm just saying, we have turkeys around here.
With a goose call in hand, could Angelo Viola, could he learn how to call geese, do you think?
With a goose call?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm good at that shit.
Yeah?
Oh.
Okay.
Watch me go.
Okay.
Why, did you want to put a little wager on something?
No, right? I'm just wondering when you hear that, the two tones of a goose and then all the different types of calling and all that. It's very intricate. It's like duck, it's like calling mallards. There's the feeding chuckles. There's the highball call. There's all kinds of different stuff that you have to learn. You know what I mean?
The barn swallow. Now, there is a difficult
You know how to call on a swallow, don't you?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Dean.
Welcome to the program. Another wonderful episode coming your way. Later on, we'll be joined by a fascinating gentleman. His name is Ryder Knowlton. And did you find this guy? Like, how does this work? Why would
I found him through a fellow podcaster, Jamie Pastilli.
Ah.
He was a client of his, and he recommended the book. So
it's a great book. Yeah. It's sitting right here, as you can see, in front of Mr. Bowman, or beside Mr. Bowman's, because there's a Mr. Bowman here, and then there's a Mr.
Easy
Bowman there.
Easy on the head there, eh?
All right.
Going to break me.
The book is called A Collection of Untold Stories. I will tell you, they are all outdoor stories. And
the guides. You forgot the main part.
Oh.
Well, it's untamed.
It's untamed. Untamed. I'm told the same thing. Like, if you were untamed, you would probably be untold because you're not tame.
It's true. Sure.
And if you were untold, it means you have no people, you know, encumbering your space. You're probably untamed as well. And
naked, too. Naked
There's
as well.
There's a bunch of bullshit.
Thank you.
Okay, sir. Jimmy.
It took you long enough. anyways, fascinating book and equally fascinating gentleman. He'll be joining us a little later on with some wonderful stories about the outdoors that we can all relate to.
Yes, sir.
For sure. In the meantime, Mr. Bowman.
Yes, sir. Fishing Canada season is hot and running right now, bud.
Just hot and running.
Right
hot
now.
And running.
Yeah, I like that. Hey, you like that, don't you, kid? Yeah, our new episodes are airing weekly as we speak on the Global Television Network and then on Sportsman Channel Canada, World Fishing Network, WFN, they call that, and on a bunch of smaller stations as well. Yeah,
and the story you're gonna go into that whole story.
That's a whole different thing.
A whole different thing.
That's the Fishing Canada Television. So, now you're gonna go to fishingcanada.com, and then the web store on top of that. There's three things that we have to intro here. You know that, right?
Well, do we? Because the listener feedback that we're going to read here in a moment might suggest that maybe not.
See, but listener feedback, we love that. And this one, I love what he or she has written in, but they have to remember that they're not the only listener. If we get new listeners in, we need to get them towards our TV show and our website and our store.
We get new people every week.
There you go.
Every week there's new people.
So we have to. Sorry for the redundancy and the repetitiveness, et cetera, if we keep going on. But sometimes we have to. That's for business. You know, we have to do that for business.
Winter sale then. Then for sure. Now that you explain it that way, I'm good with it.
Because new people need to know
the winter sale at Fishing Canada, the store, is on. It's happening. Although around here, doesn't look like winter.
Actually, you could just wear this stuff out there. Now, your thin jacket or whatever. You don't even need your winter jacket. I came in my hoodie. Just all you need now. So mild.
Yeah. Apparently, we're not having winter sales. I see we're...
Oh, is it
once
out?
Again,
it's done?
New items are in stock now. We should read all the pages in the book, apparently.
Where'd you get winter sale from anyway? Oh, you saw that white picture all the winter,
I saw
you?
That. I try and be professional. I don't want to say... Oh, we now have free shipping on all orders. No,
look,
so I look
at this fall, beautiful fall color
exactly,
sale. I'm sorry.
Exactly. It looks like looks like to me a winter scene.
We're just trying to see if Nick is listening to us.
Yeah, he's busy. He's on busy. The ball. Oh, Nick is busy, busy. He can't listen to you. Are you kidding me? Hey, did you see him? Have you seen him go through that phone while we're on here?
He can listen. These kids are multitaskers now, bud. That phone and
he can't listen to you.
They can talk on the phone and watch YouTube at the same time. I don't know how they do it.
My lovely grandson, Nicky V.
Give me a hell yeah.
He's asking you if you want a beer right now.
Yes, I'd love one. Thank you. Can we get on with the show?
Get on with the show.
So we have a listener feedback from, actually the name is Maple_32 via Apple Podcast.
That's a 5-star rating, though, isn't it, Dean?
Yep, it was.
Hello.
That's a 5-star?
Yep.
Thank you very much, Maple. Appreciate it. We appreciate all of this, including what you wrote. And Maple says, I'm 30 years old and on the road for work. I love to listen to the podcast every week. Entertaining and informative. I watched the Fish in Canada show, as he just mentioned, growing up, watching the Fish in Canada show. And I also have to say that the quality of the past couple of seasons is far better, and I can still appreciate the made-for-TV style versus the raw YouTube content that I also watch frequently. So, Volva, he's talking about you, obviously. He says the last couple of seasons he thinks are the best that we've ever produced in 40 years.
Is Volva's nickname Maple? Did Volva write this?
Yeah, well, you know what? He's getting smarter and smarter. He just might have. I don't know.
That's his new nickname now, Maple. Hey, Maple. That's a pretty good one, actually.
Anyways, thank you very much for that. Appreciate it. But there's more.
Oh, yeah. One critique is that some of the talk, now I'm assuming, and Dean is assuming as well, and Ange, I'm sure you're going to assume, this is going back to our podcast here, I think. So one critique is that, because we were just talking about Fish in Canada. Some of the topics, though important, are starting to get a bit redundant, i.e. live scope, i.e. catch and release, i.e. invasive species, etc. But I do agree with your viewpoints. I really like when you guys talk about specific trips, techniques, and have on unique guests to bring you new perspectives and discuss topics outside of my current knowledge, biology, poaching, guiding, etc. I also enjoy the format, fan questions, news, etc., and length of the show. Keep up the great work and off-the-cuff humor. So,
okay. What's going on here? So,
we obviously talk a lot about, i.e., live scope. Yeah, for sure we do. And release, we do for sure. Invasive species, well, definitely we do about all that. But
all three of those things are items that we experience every day of our lives in this business
and are passionate about.
We speak live scope because we use it pretty much every day for sure. You know, most of the year when we're out in the road, producing shows or just fishing, we are using it.
Yeah.
So it, for us to talk about it on a regular basis seems like a natural thing.
Yeah, it's a product. Right? It's a product we love to use, right? We will say that. Yeah.
Catch and release. You know, you mentioned earlier on we have new people coming into the show on a regular basis, Dean, but we also have new anglers coming into fishing on a regular basis. And most of those anglers that are coming in for the first time are from other jurisdictions that don't practice the same fish management or wildlife management that we do in this country. So I feel that it's incumbent upon us and people like us in the industry to continually talk about catch and release and other good sound management tools that are in place for fishery and wildlife. So,
and I think Maple would agree that we do talk about keeping some fish too. We certainly don't. I mean, you go to our Instagram right now, you'll see how to fillet a pike. You know what I mean? We have stuff like that.
We didn't release that baby.
That baby tasted good.
He got released right into the frying pan.
And then the invasive species thing, you know what? Yeah, maybe we're going to harp on that. This is a modern day important point that we really need to drive home. You know, it's not even, well, it is here in other species, but we're talking about the grass carp and the Asian carp, et cetera. If it hits us, people, we are in trouble. So if we can just stay ahead of that curve. We're harping on it, but it's important. You know what I mean? That one for sure.
In fact, I recently reviewed an episode that we're going to unleash on the viewing public very soon of the Fish and Canada show that has to do with that invasive species subject matter.
Absolutely.
So it's an ongoing thing. And much like the catch and release situation, we're living it every day and we just feel important. I know sometimes it gets a little redundant to folks who tune in here every episode, but there's a reason for it. And I think we, as in a group, have to continue making assumptions that not everybody is in tune with what we do and think and believe in. So,
Yep.
Having said all that,
he gave us five stars.
He gave us five stars. So we appreciate that. And, don't ever think that we're trying to, rebut it. You make good, valid points, but we just try and tell you the reason why. It sounds a little weird. And by the way, if you're not using LiveScope, if you're fishing and you're not using LiveScope, well, we're going to keep harping. See, that's just it. We're going to keep harping until you do.
There you
go. Because if you're not using that type of technology, you're not fishing today by today's standards. There you go, Maple. Thank
Come
you.
Come on now.
And if you are like Maple and would like to critique us, by all means. We enjoy it. We love it.
Sure.
It's wonderful.
It's good to hear, actually.
Make sure.
It's productive.
Much like Maple, you give us a nice 5-star rating, though, at the end of it. Because it helps us.
Come on now.
That's right. Thank you.
We'd appreciate that.
All right. Under the canopy. Boy, is it my imagination or have I seen Mr. Ouellette?
What the heck is going on?
One too many times.
I thought you hired him, maybe. I thought he's working here
now. Like this week, he's here full time. He's opening and closing the doors before we get here and before we go home. Oh,
man. This man is on fire. He is putting out episodes like crazy.
Well, we've just changed a whole new, we got him a whole new studio on his own now.
True.
You know what I mean? He's making the money for us,
he's
obviously.
He's got an office here now.
That's what I mean.
That's right. He does have now roots, right? He can come in and go.
I used to go to that office. I used to have that office.
That was your private little domain.
Jerry's got it now. Mualet.
Well, use one of your other two offices down the hall there.
No, I can't take those. Those are Nick's offices.
Oh, those are Nick's.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Anyways, new episode is up and running. It's been dropped.
Drop the needle.
For Under the Canopy, a wonderful product. If you have not hooked up with Jerry Ouellette and Under the Canopy as of yet, well, shame on you. The nice thing about podcasts is that you can always start and then go back and catch the whole dealio.
See,
when I was on radio...
Yes.
Problem is people couldn't do that.
I remember back in the day.
People couldn't do that.
That's right. They couldn't.
If they didn't tune in Saturday morning on the Fan 590 for the 2-hour show.
Yeah.
They would have.
Damn. It was almost a waste of your time, wasn't it?
It was a waste. And I had so many people say, hey, a buddy of mine said that on the show you were talking about the purple goose feathered humpernickel. And I want to know more about it because I've got one in my backyard. Well,
do you know how to call them in? Did I get a goose call?
I used to give you a little caller.
Yeah. I guess you did.
Did you notice that?
Oh, I noticed your movement there too. Yes, indeed.
And I'd have to say, well, there's nothing I could do. It's gone. It's behind us.
Into the abyss.
That too. And so now the beauty of podcast is that you can go catch it all. You haven't missed a thing. If you haven't joined until now, you haven't missed a thing.
So we have no recordings of your old radio shows? Wow.
We have them in-house here.
We have not all. No. We have the whole show? No.
No, no.
No, no. We have little clips. Like, I think, special little clips and stuff.
Yeah, I can't believe that the fan would not have kept a record of all... Of everything, were they not?
It was analog, baby. There's no real...
Yeah, they had tapes. You know.
By the way, you're going to have... I don't want to let the cat out of the bag, but we're going to have a show coming up here in the next few weeks with a very special individual that you and I have been fortunate enough to know for a number of years. And he was behind some of the production on that radio show.
Oh, yes,
and,
I do know.
And, yes. When we have him on, we're going to play some of the stuff that he produced.
Nice.
The little pieces that I listened to him the other day.
Laughter.
Yeah, I heard some of those too.
Oh my God.
maybe some new some repeating sound bites. We could put them back in our system.
Have to update the board. Yeah,
for sure, especially good. Hans and Franz.
Oh God, I can't wait.
You look a little tense.
They were good. Anyway, oh boy, there's something to look forward
you'll
to.
You'll know why we're laughing when it's going to hit in a couple of weeks on this show. So, anyways,
quickly, Jerry's interview with Jack Summers on metal detectors, which is seems to be getting to be more popular all the time. The subject is kind of you're seeing more people walking around beaches, et cetera, like that. Jack even came over one time. My wife lost her wedding ring, engagement ring. And Jack came over with a machine, and they did a search.
Did they find
Danny
it?
No, they didn't find it. But
did they find anything else?
I'm not sure if they did. They might have made some money in that deal, eh?
And, well, making money is what it's all about today, because a lot of people have started businesses.
Absolutely.
And all they do is travel around the world to hot zones. Hot zones in the metal detecting business means places that are either currently producing exotic metals and or finds, or that are historically producing this stuff. Right. So now you've got people that are making a living. That's what they do. They travel around the world with these machines that Uncle Jack sells.
Easy job. Beautiful. Walk around nice and slow, scanning, headphones on.
You know what? That'd be perfect for you.
Oh, hell yeah.
Think about it. Because you want to be slow on that job.
Right.
Right.
But so I'd have Megadeth coming through here, so I'd never be able to hear the signals. Too. I wouldn't be able to Pantera and Slayer. And wonder if my wife threw that wedding ring away. I wonder if she just tossed
it. She was trying
to get rid of it. I said, get Jack in here to find it and save my marriage.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
How'd that work out for you?
she's got the ring and she's stuck with me still.
In your gunshot, did you? Anyways, wonderful product. It's called Under the Canopy. It's on the Outdoor Journal Radio Podcast Network as we speak. How do people find the network? I've had some folks ask me, how does it work?
If you scroll down on any of our podcasts.
Okay, let's say I'm not on any of your podcasts.
Okay.
I'm sitting at home, and I don't want to watch the Leafs anymore because it's 3-0 and
they're too good.
They're too good. Thank you. So how do I get on the network?
So you open up your podcast app, whether that's Spotify or Apple or whatever you use, and you look up the name and they'll all come up in order of most played. That's how they'll come up on your phone.
What will?
All of our podcasts.
Journal, the Outdoor
Radio.
So I have to get to Outdoor. So I got to type in Outdoor Journal Radio and that's it.
That should be enough. Yeah. And they'll all come up right there. And they all have a little tag on the corner so you know they belong to us on the left side.
There you go. Right? If you didn't know, that's how you get it done.
Pretty soon you're not even going to have to do it, right? You're just going to think the Outdoor Journal Radio Podcast, and it's going to somehow come on all your devices and your computers in front of you. Out of this microphone, you're going to start hearing the headphones, and those two guys in the front, they're going to start talking to you right there, bobbling their heads.
Well, you know what? I mean, it would be a bad idea. We're not getting any younger.
It'd be a good podcast. Just have it all right.
Oh, those two guys doing it. I think it'd be great.
A good little bit anyways.
I think it'd be great.
Oh, God.
In the news at fishingcanada.com.
Yes, sir.
Because we were talking about that earlier on. The gateway, the portal to your next fishing adventure.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
In the news on said portal is first deer with chronic wasting disease found in BC.
Yeah.
Now,
so more provinces and more provinces are starting
why
to
is that significant? Well, I would think the mere geography of it all would make it significant.
Look
because
at the head on that thing. Woo! That is not good. Look at the neck.
Yeah.
Whoa. Anyway, sorry. For those just listening and not watching, it's a nasty-looking disease.
It's BC has always been treated from a wildlife standpoint as its own wildlife zone because of the
pristine
mountains.
And
well, the mountains kind of keep everything side.
I got
Now with this showing up on the other side of the divide, it's something to be concerned about. And there's a whole story about it on the news.
You know what the weird one is, and Dean and I were talking about this yesterday, is that Ontario still has not had a case, a reported case.
We've never had
a
confirmed case ever.
Ontario.
Really?
Yep.
We've got as many deer as almost anybody. We're surrounded by it. I got looking at the map yesterday. Now, I mean, in the summertime, there's a lot of water that separates the U.S. Like northern U.S. has a lot, right?
Dean? A ton, yeah.
A ton. There's a lot of water that separates. But up in northern Minnesota, I think it's Minnesota, there is a chance they could come across the border there quite easily, right? But up until then, it might be difficult for them if it doesn't freeze, if the rivers don't freeze, et cetera, et cetera. But there has to be deer up here. People are just ignoring it, or I don't think
people test as much as they should, probably.
Right.
Most hunters don't even know about it. It's not a concern, but
right. Yeah. And, it's probably that it is.
And it's funny because when it's not in your own backyard, you don't really.
Right.
And do you want to know?
Like, well, that's the other thing. You don't know, don't hurt
you. I wouldn't want to find out that I ate a deer with CWD. I've eaten a lot of deer.
Right.
I don't really. I'd prefer not to know.
That's one way of looking at it, I guess.
At the risk of sounding stupid, because I haven't read the article that is on fishingcanada.com in the news section that's headlined by First Deer with Chronic Wasting Disease Found in BC. I haven't read that. Does it talk about... what you just said, you know, if a human comes in contact with a deer with CWD or chronic waste disease, is it something that we can catch?
So it's not advised that you consume it because there's never been a confirmed case in humans, right. But they did a study on macaws, which are pretty much as close to humans as you can get. And they got CWD just by eating the meat.
Wow.
So they caught it. Humans have never, but you don't want to be the first one.
Very
so.
Quickly, how did it affect the macaws? What did happen?
That I don't
them?
Know. But don't it, know? It's like it's deadly, like 100% you won't right. survive CWD.
Wow.
All these deer die. So.
And then episode 90 of the of our podcast, our Outdoor Journal Radio yep. podcast, Zombie Deer Disease with Larissa.
We did a whole thing on that.
A whole thing on that too. So if anybody wants to listen up and learn a little bit more about that, it's an interesting subject and obviously very little known about it really. Especially Ontarians.
You would think we'd be right up to date on it. Everybody would.
Especially
know.
With the amount of deer that we have in this province.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a lot of whitetail in this province, right?
Oh, yeah.
Tons.
Yeah,
tons. Very quickly, is there like a mule deer more affected by it or easier affected by it than whitetail?
Mule deer
like
were the first ones to get it.
Okay.
And I think it started in Colorado.
There's what happens.
A couple of
zombies. There's what happens if you come in contact with that right
there. Yeah. Yeah, and deer look good up there anyway.
I know. Anyways, it's a story that we should all be staying in touch with. It's sitting there right now waiting for you to read it on the fishingcanada.com portal.
Yes, sir.
Under news.
Under news. How about the this week's fan question, Angelo?
Well, how about it?
How about from Brandon Forbes from Alberta? Another Albertan. I love this. We get lots of Westerners that are listening in and joining us. I mean, they love their fishing. They love their fishing and hunting.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God, hunting.
And drinking.
You figure? Well, they should love drinking. This is one of the first provinces to have the drive-through beer.
That's right.
Damn it. Pull up. Right. Hey, give me a 12-pack. After hours, give me a 12 Canadian or whatever you want to get. Yeah? Hell yeah. Anyways, Brandon, we're not saying that Brandon, you're a drinker or you're not drinking.
No.
We're not saying anything like that.
Nor do we.
We don't drink?
Well, saying? No, we don't want to sound like a bunch of, you know, drunks. Do we?
Probably did, but that intro to this right there probably sound like a couple of crackheads or something.
Oh, that's nice. Well, that's going to translate really well.
Well, you know, just saying.
All right.
Brandon asks.
By the way, did you hear, what's his name?
Crackhead Bob?
No.
I love Crackhead Bob.
I do too. Yeah, I miss him. But no, Bublé. Bublé on
Michael Bublé.
Yeah, he was on the NHL's All-Star event.
No, I didn't see it.
You didn't watch that?
No,
it was hilarious. Did you watch it, Dean?
I didn't watch it. No.
Oh, so he comes on. So
I love that guy. He's got a great sense of humor.
Oh, does he ever?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Oh yeah.
So he comes on. He's a little bit on the wild side during the event itself because he was one of the team co-captains.
Right.
And anyways, then they did an interview with him, sort of away from that venue, just as an interview post.
Right. Yeah.
And man, he was hilarious. He's, Frank, what'd you give me? You told me with that mushroom was just like, and he goes into this whole thing about his buddy Frank, who gave him this mushroom that he said, it'll chill you a little bit. Just get the nerves out before the NHL thing and you'll be fine. Anyways, he's giving this guy shit that it wasn't just, you know, anyways.
I'm going to look it up. I'm sure we can be able to find
hilarious.
That.
And that reminded me of you with the comment.
With the comment. Yeah.
That's right.
Crackhead Bob.
That's right. So, carry on.
Crackhead Bublé. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know. I mean, some people might look at that interview and say, whoa.
Anyways, Brandon Forbes from Alberta says, do you think the popularity of fishing on social media has had a positive or negative effect on the sport and certain areas? Mm-hmm. That's a good one. I mean, it's going to be just our opinions, right? But
so that I don't get this right. So Brandon wants to know, has the internet had a positive or negative effect on fishing? Is that what he's basically saying?
On the sport, on fishing in general and in certain areas.
And some fishing areas. I'm assuming that's what he's asking.
That's what it looks like to me. Yep. Yeah.
Well, that's a great question.
That's because I think it's had both probably. I'm going to say it's had to have had both, right?
So more people are fishing because of the internet?
The popularity, it can't not make it more popular because you're making it more popular by posting and posting and posting.
Right? Here's what I can tell you with total certainty, that the license sales here in this country, if you were to do a 2-decade study,
yes,
maybe even a 3-decade study would probably be a little more informative, you'll see that there's been a decline in license sales.
Really?
Yeah. Like per capita?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. So now, having said that, we know that more people are fishing. Mm. So there's a bit of a disconnect there.
Or more
somewhere.
People are publicly fishing. Like they tell you they're
they tell you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, we see it too.
Yeah.
We see it out in the field. I think we see more people fishing today.
Yeah. It seems like that. To us, anyways.
Our population has expanded, but yet, if we go back 25 years, you'll see that with a much smaller population, we had greater fishing license sales throughout the country.
Interesting.
Yeah. At one point, that number was 6.8 million licenses were sold, or was it 8 million, I can't remember. Anyways, I know I've looked at the numbers, and there's been a bit of a decline in license sales. Now, since COVID, we haven't seen any numbers, so I don't know how COVID impacted. I'm sure COVID had an impact on
it. They said the immediate impact was huge, way up, but now it's probably leveling out, I would think, right? So
it's not as big a boost as we may think over the last decade or so, but
It's given the, let's go to the negative side here, in my opinion. Social media has given the, whatever you want to call them, keyboard cowboys, the peckerheads is what I'll call them.
Easy.
Given them that, hey, what are you doing with this fish? Why are you doing that? Why are you fishing? Why are you hurting the, so it's brought more negativity, or them to be able to give their negative comments more to the public, right? And get shared by 1,000, 1,000,000 people, whatever it is. So it's brought maybe more light to negativity on it. But those numbers of people are minuscule compared to the positives, I think, that are in the social media world, I think. I mean, if they see a picture of your big muskie from the St. Lawrence River, not many that are going to say, oh, my God, you hurt that fish, Angelo. You're going to see a lot of people that are going to say, oh, my God, I need to catch one of those myself. That is a mutant of a fish, 50 pounds of muskie, fantastic, well done. Got to be higher. Got to be a higher ratio.
I don't know. With Dean, total what do you certainty think? With that.
Higher or lower? More positive or more negative with Ange holding up a 50-pound muskie in a picture, a social media picture?
More positive because of the people who follow us. But I think if you put that on an account that wasn't ours, it would be mostly negative.
Really?
Like if you put it on like the CBC.
Oh, okay. Something like that, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, like I'm hugging this big slimy fish. You know, I don't know. I don't.
Good question.
The other one's probably interesting to me, and that is as it pertains to certain areas. Mm-hmm. So, I think he's saying there have some of the hidden fishing gems now been exposed through social media.
Well,
is that what he's saying?
I'll give you a shot. My shot on that one too, as well. I think the norm of social media posts and fishing are hiding where they're fishing. That's just my thought. They you see them horribly blurred out backgrounds all the time.
Yeah.
You know, if you find out the leg he's on Rice Lake.
Besides Ryan Flero, who are you talking about?
No, look, honestly, you'll look on that and you'll see that there's hardly anything about where they caught him, you know what I mean, or something like that. It's like pretty opposite of what the Fish in Canada show is. And maybe justifiably so. You know, maybe you don't want to put a post out there that goes to millions upon millions and is in a popular area. I don't know. But I think it's more not talked about than talked about in that sense. Hidden. So I don't think it's too detrimental on the areas.
No. So the areas are okay. They've escaped.
Okay-ish.
One of the best spots I have out west where I went to school was from a YouTube video. Background of a YouTube video, you could see a bridge. Looked at a map, found the bridge.
Dean's one of those guys. One of those guys.
I was one of those guys. Yeah.
Now you find it. You said, "Oh shit! I've seen what I can do. Somebody else can do that." Yeah. So it happens like that. That's going to happen. Well, I remember that on a Fish in Canada episode one time on Bay of Quinte. Me and your brother, Earl Reno, we were fishing on a spot that I had found a tiny spot from us to the camera away. That's it, a little wee tiny spot. And the cameraman decided to go on shore. And in doing so, he shot the other side, which had a tower on the other side. And next season, I saw about 16 boats hitting that thing throughout. Every time you go there, just guys were just pounding it. And I never caught a fish off it again, something like that. So it happens. But, oh well. Good question, I think.
Thank you, Brandon Forbes from Alberta via email. That's by the way, the best way to get a hold of us.
I don't know if I said his name wrong. You just did. It's Forbes, unless we spelt it wrong.
I copied that right from the email.
Forbes.
He may have spelled it right.
I said Forbes, didn't I?
You did. I think I might have too.
You might have too. And the only reason I said Forbes is because you did.
Oh, we got to play that back right now. And I didn't even have to play that back, Dean, after the show. Just please, just for my own sake.
It's the only reason, because I can clearly see it's Forbes.
Yeah, I know.
But because I'm
subliminally
subjected to the constant.
My power.
Constant.
The power of Pete. The Petey power.
I screwed it up. And then people think it's me. And it's not me.
It's not him, folks. Trust me.
It's me. It's not me. It's him. Terrible influence. He's the problem. That question should be, what kind of negative influence has Peter Bowman had on me?
I am the crackhead in this group.
Yes, okay? You are.
Not us. Me.
Yes.
Don't do Doug's.
You're an idiot. The humble goldfish, everyone's favorite aquatic pet. It's small, easy to care for. What's there not to love?
Even the cat may be mesmerized by the color and movements of your aquarium friends. Goldfish are great at home, but don't let them loose.
Releasing goldfish or other domestic aquatic pets or plants into natural environments is harmful to both your pet and the planet.
Goldfish disrupt ecosystems by outcompeting native species for food and resources in degraded habitats. They contribute to algae blooms, they kill aquatic wildlife, and pass viruses and diseases contracted in aquariums to wild fish.
They could even live up to 40 years and grow as big as a football. Anglers, this is where you come in. If you find a goldfish at your local fishing spot, report it to the invading species hotline or go online to eddmaps.com.
Remember to never dump your live bait into the water and risk spreading other aquatic invaders. Keep our lakes free from invaders and don't let them loose.
There's an adventure just outside these walls.
It's something you'll hate to leave and can't wait to get back to.
It's a place where memories are made and bonds are forged.
For some, it's hitting the trails. For others, it's a weekend at the lake. It's a place full of campfires and quality time.
This year, take some time to reconnect with friends, family, and nature. No matter what adventures await you, Coleman has the gear you need. Visit ColemanCanada.ca to gear up today.
The outside is calling.
Answer the call.
What brings people together more than fishing and hunting?
How about food?
I'm Chef Antonio Maleca, and I've spent years catering to the stars. Now, on Outdoor Journal Radio's Eat and Wild podcast, Luigi, Hookset, and I are bringing our expertise
and Rolodex to our real passion, the outdoors.
Each week, we're bringing you inside the boat, tree stand, or duck blind and giving you real advice that you can use to make the most out of your fishing game.
You're going to flip that duck breast over once you get a nice hard sear on that breast. You don't want to sear the actual meat.
And it's not just us chatting here. If you can name a celebrity, we've probably worked with them. And I think you might be surprised who likes to hunt and fish.
When Kit Harrington asks me to prepare him sashimi with his bass, I couldn't say no.
Whatever Taylor Sheridan wanted, I made sure I had it.
Burgers, steak, anything off the barbecue. That's a true cowboy.
All Jeremy Renner wanted to have was lemon ginger shots all day.
Find Eating Wild now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
All righty then, let's get to the main feature of the show. Joining us now, a fascinating gentleman. Let me take that
He's
back.
It's got to be fascinating if you call him the main feature, because you and I should be the main features.
Oh,
but
you lost that. You lost that a long time ago. But
I've never had it.
Author of an incredible book that I highly recommend folks get out and find. It's a collection of untamed stories. And the author is Ryder Knowlton, who joins us now. Ryder, how are you?
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
Doing great, man.
Doing great, buddy.
Thanks for taking the time to join us. So before we get into the book itself, because there's some fascinating things that I want to go over on that part of it, tell us a little bit about how the book came about. What was the genesis of you saying, because I'm always intrigued by this. Like, authors wake up one day and say, I am going to author a book. Is that the way it works?
Yeah, you know, this one was an evolution. It was more of a journey than a project. You know, from soup to nuts, the whole thing probably took 10 years. And it's because it probably started from, as you said, an inspiration to do it. And then evolved into, really at the time, was just going to be a collection of stories that I wanted to record so that I could share them with our kids someday or share them with friends. Really, it didn't evolve into a book until well down the path. And you know, the inspiration for it probably, you know, started, if I really go back to kind of my early days, you know, the stuff that my family, meaning, you know, my dad, my grandfather, you know, the things that they always valued, they never really cared what you had materialistically, but if you could carve a decoy, you know, or if you could make a turkey call, yeah, or even better, if you could work a turkey call, you know, that's the stuff that my dad.
If you could catch a fish, if you get a fish in the boat,
then you really impress the family, you know. And so I just grew up in a family where, you know, knowledge of the outdoors was not just valued, but it was really respected. And so I feel like I kind of grew up in that environment. And you know, I grew up on a little farm, an old family farm. I was the fourth generation on the farm in central New York. And when I went off to college, my dad got a job in the Port of Savannah. And so we moved to Savannah, Georgia, great big culture shock, as you can imagine, going from upstate to New York to the deep South. But, you know, as part of that process, we got to know some of the folks in that area. And one of the people who lives in the low country, if you will, that part of Georgia, is a guy named Raz Reed. And this goes back now 30 years. But, you know, back in the early 90s, Raz was with Sage Rods. And because of our family relationship, I got to meet a bunch of the guys at Sage Rods at an early stage of my, you know, outdoor life, if you will, my sporting career. And this would have been kind of early to mid 20s. And I was allowed to tag along with those guys, with Raz and his crew, on some incredible trips. And by tag along, you know, my job was to keep my mouth shut and, you know, and learn and not ask too many questions, but I was allowed to go. And, you know, in those days, this would have been early to mid 90s. Those were some of the best fly fishermen in the world at that time. Yeah. And I just...
We knew somebody before
from,
I forget.
From Sage?
From Sage. Back in the 90s, mid-90s.
Oh, my God, buddy.
And who in the hell was that? Damn, I hate getting old, Ryder, because...
Oh, yeah, I'm right there with you, Ange. The guy from the north, you know, Raz, of course, was the Sage rep for the southeastern U.S.
Right.
But the guy up north that would always be part of the group was a guy named George Cook. And George, you know, he had that Vancouver Seattle, you know, range for Sage. Yeah. And then there were guys like Ed Ward. Ed Ward at that time was one of the top spaycasters in the world. And these were guys, a lot of the guys from Alaska. And anyways, it just, even though I was just a normal guy with a job and a wife and kids and student loans, I was exposed to people who were, you know, in essence, professional fishermen, you know, and they were, and that was an inspiring time for me. I got to be around these people and not only learn, but realize, wow, these guys, you know, make a living doing this. And these guys, you know, get to travel the world, you know, fishing. Right. And how cool is that? And, you know, and so, you know, the whole guide thing for me probably didn't start really till then. I got then into my 30s is since we grew up on a farm, you know, going out, if we wanted to go hunting for rabbits or something, we just went out back.
Right.
And then when we moved to Georgia for the first time in my life, and that would have been my late teens, early 20s, I got exposed to like leasing land. You know, if you want to have property to go do stuff outside and you don't have the farm anymore, you lease property. But when I got in my 30s, I started kind of getting the first taste of travel, sporting travel, traveling to go fishing, traveling to go hunting. And, you know, if you're from the Eastern U.S. like I am, those first little forays into the West, you know, for us are usually maybe it's antelope hunting in Wyoming. Maybe it's the first step of whitetail hunting into Texas. And those were the first baby steps I took. But that was where for the first time I realized, wow, these, you know, this is what a guide is. And I got introduced to guides and quickly learned that if you're not in your own backyard, man, there's these folks are invaluable. And I just formed some great friendships and over time heard some great stories. And those stories eventually turned obviously into the book.
I'm curious, how did you pay the bills during this adventure, this journey that you went on?
Yeah, because that cannot be cheap, especially exactly. By the places that you've been. You got to be able to fund it and afford it or whatever,
What do you do for a living? What did you do for a living?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I get asked it all the time. And there's probably two answers. People say, how do you do it? And there's probably two answers. The first is, thank goodness I've got a supportive wife that knows it's an important part of my life.
Right.
And that's obviously important. You know, really there have been two phases to my sporting life. And to answer your question, Pete, I'm in commercial real estate. So I'm a real estate guy. You know, I spent most of my career in Atlanta and for the last 10 years I've been working in the Charlotte market. But you know, there's really been two phases. There's kind of my early days where I didn't have any money at all, you know, and both my wife and I come from very modest families. My folks live today, to this day, my folks live in a one bedroom farmhouse outside of Savannah, Georgia. And you know, our kids to this day, and they're both now in their 20s, but our kids to this day have never slept in a bed visiting the grandparents. You know, you slept on the floor. If you were lucky, you got a couch. And if you were really lucky, somebody would go find a cot, pull a cot from the barn and set it up for you. But, you know, in those days, you know, I had no funds and obviously you always have time limitations. And so I say there was probably two things. One, you know, I prioritized fishing and hunting so much. You know, I was kind of forming my real estate career. You know, I was maybe getting to be known as one of the new young guys who, you know, could put together real estate deals in Atlanta. But at that time, I had no money and I was covered up in student loan debt. Yeah. And so you're going to laugh at this, but I literally spent my 20s driving the same old beat up truck with 300,000 miles on it and no air conditioning. And until you lived in Georgia with no air conditioning, you know yourself at another whole level.
For sure. Yeah. Wow.
So the reason we brought you on the show, by the way.
Can I ask one more question before we get too far?
Yeah.
When you're writing a book, going back to the writing thing, do you just have a pad and paper there and you just start scrubbing stuff down? Do you talk into your phone? You got 10 years of recording this stuff before you even put it out. What do you do to get that finally to a book? What's the process?
Yeah, Pete. No, it's, you know, so the early inspiration was probably the Condit family of Wyoming. And this is a legendary outfitting family out West. And I've spent 20 years now with Mark Condit and we've hunted all sorts of stuff together. But in those days, in the early days of me hearing these stories, and maybe I was sitting in a ranch house or maybe I was sitting around a campfire, but I started literally the only piece of paper I would have was my boarding pass from wherever I had flown in from. And, you know, and I did a lot of, you know, I was getting into mountain hunting, I was packing light, and that would be the only piece of paper I would have. And so I would literally you know, I would hear stories around the camp. And that night, whether I was sleeping in the bottom of a bunkhouse or out literally sometimes in a one-man tent stuck on the side of a mountain, you know, with a headlamp at night, I would jot down, you know, notes from the stories I'd heard that day around the camp. And I did that for years and years until literally I had this stack of boarding passes.
That's
from
awesome.
Years of notes. And I said, man, I got to type this stuff up. I'm going to lose these things. And yeah. So eventually I typed them up, and that effectively kind of became the first draft, if you will, you know, of the guides.
That's cool. That's a great story. That's, I mean, imagine if you and I had done that from day one of Fishing Canada through Outdoor Journal, the traveling and all that. Oh my God.
So, yeah. We brought you on the show because we often hear stories. We interview guides. We do a lot of work with guides. We use guides ourselves all the time. But the part that was interesting from for this story was that we're getting stories from the other side. You know, you're a guy who uses guides, who has used guides all his life. And what's really fascinating is that you've been able to take all of these wonderful journeys that guides have been on and put them into a book. And that's what makes the storylines here, the whole thing fascinating. And now I know why, having talked to you this morning, I know why you were the type to get all of this wonderful, we'll call them folklore, because I'm sure a lot of them are not, you just pick this stuff up from a guide and assume that he was telling you the truth, right?
You do the best you can. And I'll be honest with you, you can't make some of this stuff up.
These are
folks that live and breathe. You know, at the end of the trip, I fly back to civilization. These folks live out there. These folks live in the jungles, and they live up in Nunavut, or they live out in the middle of Alaska, and this is their life year round. So you can't make the day-to-day life that these folks have, you just can't make it up.
And on that note, I certainly a lot of the stories in the book originate from Canada. The fascination with Canada, but, and I'm talking as an American that you are, there's a fascination with Canada that it's the last frontier, and we have to get up there before our before it's over, and we have to get up there and hunt and fish and discover things. That's still going on today, not just when you were doing the early research for this book, but it's still going on today. Americans are fascinated with our outdoors in Canada. Give us a little bit of perspective on that, would you?
Yeah, and is it everything that you thought it was going to be?
Yeah, you know, everything you're saying is so accurate. You know, when you think about, and this is just my perspective, when I think about the great wilderness of the world, and listen, people today are starting to explore Antarctica, and Greenland's now become a destination. So I get all that. But when you really think about, you know, kind of the practical places, if you will, when you think about real wilderness, you know, you think about parts of the Amazon. You think about, you know, surely you think about Western or Northern Alaska. You got to think about some of the big concessions in wild Africa, mm-hmm. you know, and yeah, big parts of Australia are remote, but the areas that are really sporting destinations, you know, are pretty defined. And so when you really start thinking about it, I mean, I'm not sure that Canada isn't the greatest wilderness on earth, really, if you really think about it. And then you start thinking about the diversity, the incredible diversity of Canada, and you just work your way across the provinces, and you start in the east and think about the, you know, what today to this day is maybe my number one bucket list, you know, wish list of all time, is to get up into Labrador or Newfoundland and go try to catch a 6-pound brookie, which you guys do all the time, but for me would be a dream, you know. Then you know, you think about the legendary salmon fishing of the St. Lawrence in Quebec, and yeah. you think about the legendary, you know, the fish, oh my gosh, the maybe the greatest fishing in the world in Ontario, and then work, you know, getting into, you know, some of the most beautiful Rocky Mountains in North America, the Canadian Rockies, and then eventually you get to what, you know, people talk about is the Serengeti of North America, which is BC. You know, and maybe the greatest list of big game. Surely the area that would closest rival Africa, you know, for just You know, incredible big game would be British Columbia. So, yeah, no, I think Canada has that view, and I think it rightfully deserves it.
Here's a loaded question.
Loaded
question for you. Are Canadians as nice people as everybody says?
You know, the answer is absolutely yes, but I want to give it more depth than that. I think this outdoor folks, you know, sporting people,
right?
Men and women that, you know, that appreciate the outdoors. And I'm not talking about just catching a fish or shooting some game. I mean, people that appreciate the outdoors and appreciate that experience. You know, those are special people. And I think those people are special wherever you find them around the world. I have found that as I've been around the world doing this, I have found that is a consistent theme, whether you're in parts of rural Africa or parts of remote Nunavut. It's just the same similar thing. But yeah, no, Canadians, you'd be hard pressed to find a group of people that are more enjoyable to be around than Canadians.
And why wouldn't we? We live here.
Yeah.
You guys get to enjoy it every day.
Yeah.
We live that
lifestyle.
Yeah, you don't have to fly through Minneapolis and then head up and, you know, take a flight up into Calgary. You guys are there.
True.
Ryder, you mentioned in the book that your first connection to the outdoors was fishing, and it wasn't till later in life that you started appreciating the hunt a little bit more. Take us through that, if you will, please.
Well, you know, I grew up, Central New York is a wonderful outdoors place, and to be honest with you, it's taken me to grow up to appreciate what I had as a kid. As a kid, you never really appreciate, that necessarily what you have right in front of you. And, but hunting in the Northeast is tough. You know, obviously the weather's tough. You just don't have the number of animals. And specifically, you do a lot of still hunting. In other words, moving slowly through the woods. When I went hunting with my dad and was learning, including in the early days when I got to carry an unloaded gun, but, you know, I still went along, you know, you still hunt. You're moving through the woods and trying to get up to an animal. When we moved to Georgia, you know, one of the incredible things about southern hunting versus northern hunting for me as a kid at that time was the whole concept of food plots and box stands. And by food plots, you're attracting, you know, you've got these areas where you're seeing, you know, instead of thick brush, you're seeing animals in open fields. And you have a visual relationship and an optical relationship with those animals that you just don't get as a still hunter, you know, in the snowy woods of Central New York. And then to be honest with you, you know, a box stand is great for a young person that's fidgety and moving around and would maybe be scaring everything under the sun if they're out in the wild. But when you have the luxury of sitting in a big box, you're blocked. And so I just think that southern hunting for a kid at that time, for me, that would have been late teens. Southern hunting for me just gave me I found it more exciting because you're seeing more stuff and you could kind of have more freedom to move around. Fishing for us from the start was always a very serious thing in our family. You know, we ate fish that we caught. You know, we were a self-sustaining family, and hunting and fishing meant food for us. And so, you know, fishing with my dad was never a father-son bonding thing. It was just something we did. And we did it, you know, in those days, you know, to fill up the freezer with fish. Yeah. And this was back in the 70s. And so I think this fishing for me probably was my first step. You know, you had asked early on, how the heck did you afford to do some of those early trips? And the answer to it was, even at the time when I had no money, I in real estate, as I would get deals done, this is in my 20s and early 30s, you know, in Atlanta, when you got a deal done, if the deal warranted celebration, if it was people, you know, if your client was happy and maybe it spoke to you, might have a chance to do another deal with down the day, you know, or down the road. And everybody said, yeah, let's go celebrate it. Well, in Atlanta, for the most part, that means taking somebody golfing. Right. You know, Atlanta's got great steak houses. So maybe you take them out for a steak. Well, the first deal I did that warranted a celebration, I was about 26 years old. And to this day, I can't believe I thought of it. But I called my client and I said, we should celebrate this one. And I want to take him fishing.
Wow.
And the client surprisingly said, okay, give it a shot. And I booked my first outfitting trip, as a fishing trip. And what I you guys will laugh. You'll remember this legendary place of the 80s and 90s. I took them to the old Peace and Plenty Lodge on Exuma in the Bahamas, which 40 years ago was, if you were a bone fisherman, that's where you went.
Yeah.
And it was a 2-day trip. And that was it. 2-day trip, about a day and a half of fishing. And we flew in and the plane landed and it started raining and it didn't stop raining for 2 days. We spent 2 days sitting at the bar, drinking rum drinks and smoking cigars. And I was scared to death that I had blown it. And we get back and I'm thinking I'm going to get fired.
Yeah.
And we get back and the two clients called me the next day and they said, man, we had a blast.
Time of their life.
Doing
right?
that. And they had, these guys might've done a bunch of golf stuff, but they'd never done an adventure fishing trip. And even though we spent 2 days sitting at the bar smoking cigars, that it was for them, it was a time of their life. And so that became kind of the way that I then took it from there and I would take folks fishing. You can do a deal with me. Heck, we'll go fishing. And that's how I was able to afford those early trips. I was able to tie it into my business. Where I could do things I normally, wouldn't have been able to, to afford.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Think about that.
We say that all the time. I mean, fishing is the backdrop for us. It's the theater. It's what allows us to have those moments like you just talked about. I'm not suggesting that sitting around a bar in the Bahamas smoking cigars is necessarily the best thing to do.
But it
ain't the worst.
That's
but,
for sure.
But without fishing, without that being the theater, you would have never been able to bond with those customers the way did. And I can't say enough about that as it pertains. Hunting, not so much, because you have to be a little more connected to hunting in order to.
Sure. It's a different audience.
It's different. Yeah. But in terms of fishing, it's just, to me, it's a great. And if the person has never fished before in their life, even better. Even better to take them on that adventure and once again, using fishing as the excuse, but taking that opportunity to make a connection, a relationship, a bond with that person is just key.
And it's good business. Those are bonds that are good business too. So it's a win-win all around.
I'm going to go back to your hunting situations because it intrigued me. When you're in the, what do you call it, in the box, in a field box or whatever it is, hunting in a field.
Yeah, box stand, sure.
To me, although it sounds so simple and it's cruel or whatever like that, I don't want to look at it that way. Would it not allow you to become a much better marksman though in doing that? Because now you've got, where you have to shoot that animal, a clean kill and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Versus out in the wild when you're walking through the Rocky Mountains, you're all tired and you get it. You know what I mean? Does it not help your shooting abilities? Would it?
Yeah, I think it's different skills. I think you're spot on, Pete, and it's a different experience. If you were to say who are the best hunters that I have experienced, that I have, spent time with, obviously there are turkey hunters and whitetail hunters, for me in the U.S., that are among the best hunters I know, but nobody compares to the Aboriginal local, if you go to Africa and spend time with the local native trackers, that's hunting, where you're literally tracking an animal. And, and what we're doing is we're field to table. In other words, we're hunting, old mature bucks that are kind of past their time, and we're going to try to fill a freezer and feed the family.
Yep.
But depending on, when you talk about box stands, box stands absolutely require, great practice of shooting ability, but also understanding distance and also understanding ballistics.
Right.
And, where maybe as a still hunter, it works your patience more, and it's maybe being more aware of your surroundings in a local and in your environment so that you can move quietly and be an effective hunter. So yeah, all the different styles absolutely pull on different strengths. I am not a good shot. I am not what you consider a good long shot. I like close shots, obviously ethical shots. And so, but at the same time, I have friends who are experts in ballistics and are very capable and enjoy taking long shots and can do it ethically. And so I always appreciate that.
Cool.
Before we get into some notable stories in the book that I just wanted to touch on, give me your best fishing location that you've ever gone to.
Oh man. Well, I'm going to say that I have had lots of experience hunting throughout Canada. I have very limited experience hunting throughout Canada. And so as far as places that I would like to spend more time fishing, Canada, I mean, if I listed, you know, the top five bucket list places or things for me to do in the world of fishing, number one, without question, is to go try to truly get one of the legendary big brook trout, you know, of Labrador or Newfoundland. And I've tried it and failed in Maine, but, you know, someday I'd love to get up to Labrador and Newfoundland. Another top five for me would be, without question, going after big pike. You know, I've done a lot of pike fishing on fly, you know, that I've caught a lot of 28 to 32 inch, you know, small pike on fly, but I've never gone on a really trophy lake, you know, where you're sight casting at big pike, you know, and that would be a top one for me. But as far as places to go, you know, if I had to really think about where are the top fishing places, my favorite, if I had to pick one fishing, you know, one type of fishing to do, what is my true favorite? It would have to be baby tarpon. And I say baby tarpon, obviously there's nothing like hooking into a 140-pound, 7-foot tarpon, you know, out in 2 feet of water and having that whole experience. But the part of fishing that I personally like the best is the hookup. In other words, the experience of seeing the fish, making a cast, having the fish interact with your, whether it's a plug or bait or your fly, whatever it is, but the interaction of the fish where they then take that. And then if I can fight a 20-pound fish instead of a 120-pound fish, I don't mind that one bit. I'd rather fight the 20-pound fish.
How true is that? You make a really good point because sometimes we get hung up on size, and in terms of fish catching, you're absolutely right, because 20 to 30 pound tarpon in relatively shallow water is probably one of the most exciting experiences can have. That 150 and beyond is really not a fun experience. We equated to sturgeon, for example, on the Fraser River.
God.
Like, we all go out there because we want to hook up with a 10 footer. That's kind of the lure, right? Yep. But once you do, if you're fortunate enough to do that, you never want to do it again.
I'm done. I'm done. Everybody else, you know.
Tuna, you know, we all want to hook up with a 1,000-pound tuna.
But you only want to do it once.
While you're doing it, you don't want to do it anymore either. So in the middle of the fight, you want, as Pete said, you want to tap out.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you brought that up. That's a really good point.
I also agree with Ryder too. I think everybody has maybe a different perception when they are a different like or their best part of fishing. But I'm like Ryder. After I hook that fish, it's kind of like then it starts to just mellow out. But it's that whole excitement. Even if you're not sight fishing is the best. But even if you're not, you're fishing a weed line. You drop and then your jig drops down and all of a sudden, boom, and as you know, that's a big old largemouth, or could be a big old, set the hook. And, you know, that's the most fun part as well. I agree with that one. Just, you know, that bite, that getting it, just luring it in and getting that bite. And then
I'm listening to you guys and you know, we've had guests on the show and we ourselves have pussyfooted around the issue too. You know, are we looking at down the road, some point down the road, fishing hookless? Is that a possibility?
No, I still won't do that.
You still won't do that?
No, because I threw my jig out there. And you felt,
boom.
That's right.
That's it, you're done.
It's a dirty old muskie, and I don't want anything to do with him. Good. I want my largemouth.
Have you ever thought of that?
You know, it's funny. You guys had a recent show that I thought was so interesting about some of the new regulations in parts of Canada about releasing in time before you have to release the fish. And does that theoretically, right, affect, you know, taking pictures? And Ange, I think you had made the comment, or Pete, maybe it was you that made the comment that, you know, your buddy can always take a picture of you as you release the fish. And that's such a cool shot seeing the release. But, you know, another part of fishing that I love, I have to admit, I am an absolute nerd for beautiful fish photography. And I love seeing the colors of a, you know, whether it's a brookie or you guys had a show recently on a part of the Albany River system where you guys were catching walleyes, and the yellows in the walleye were just remarkable.
Yeah, gorgeous.
And then of course, smallies, I think, are the prettiest fish of all, and a good photo, good bronze back. And, you know, and so that part of it too, I want to land that fish because I do want to get a quick picture.
Yeah.
All right. No, so Catherine is on her own.
Catherine's going to be a one person deal in that whole.
We know an angler that, has been practicing that for about 10 years now. She's a fly angler. She has no hooks. She just goes out and does her thing and gets that rise, and boom, she's done.
What do you think, Dean? Would you do it? Hookless?
I like to eat too much.
Atta boy. We interrupt this program to bring you the much-anticipated bonus code for the latest Fishing Canada giveaways. This week's code is TRACKER. That is all capitals, T-R-A-C-K-E-R. TRACKER. Just type that in the bonus code section of the contest and receive 100 free entries towards all our current giveaways. For those of you who aren't entered, what are you waiting for? Head over to fishingcanada.com while you listen to the rest of this episode, click contests, and sign up for all the latest Fishing Canada giveaways. And now, back to the episode.
All right, let's get to some stories. There's a fascinating story here, a hilarious story, about a guide's grandfather that hit an alligator as they drove to their duck blind. Talk to us about that.
You know, that story came from a guy named Seth Vernon, and there was a great article. It was in one of the fishing magazines. It was probably 10 or 15 years ago. You guys might have seen the book. You know, it's a classic fly fishing book, 50 Places to Fly Fish Before You Die. Well, that's, you know, and there was an article in this magazine that had 10 fishing guides to fish with before you die. Well, number 7 or 8 was this guy named Seth Vernon out of Wilmington, North Carolina. And so I reached out, and Seth and I have since become great buddies, and we've been fishing together for years. But one day, you know, and the reason I like Seth is he's more than just a fishing guide. He knows that area, he knows the environment. You're going to learn about the wildlife. You're going to learn about the marshes, the tidal flats, the delta of the Cape Fear River system. You know, he's just this encyclopedia of knowledge. And one day he and I were out, searching for redfish in the tidal flats along the intercoastal waterway of eastern North Carolina. And he's pulling and I'm looking, and it's a slow day. And Seth goes, "Hey Ryder, did I ever tell you that my grandfather was an alligator poacher?" And I kind of put down the rod. I was like, "No, but we got to talk about that right this second." And we ended up spending the afternoon just sitting on his flats boat in the marsh, not even fishing, just talking. And he told me these stories. And of course he talked about his neighbor. I think it was, you know, he and his grandfather and his neighbor, his uncle and his neighbor going out, and the big gator coming up and hitting the boat and tipping the canoe. But the craziest part of that story was, you know, when young Seth was a kid, he would go out to that camp and he would talk about the three-legged dogs. And there were always three-legged dogs around camp. And he finally asked my uncle, he said, "Hey, you know, why are all the dogs around camp three-legged?" And they said, "Because of the gators."
Yeah.
No
way.
He
said, you know, that's just part of being on the, you know, on the, this family, the area we're talking about is the bayou around New Orleans. That's where Seth's family was from. And and that's where their camp was way back in that territory. So yeah, gators were a real part of their life for sure.
Those dogs must've been good escape artists. So damn it, they get away with, you know, they could have been eaten fully. They got away with their leg only.
But you saved your life.
I'm sure there was a few that never came back.
I got a feeling.
We spent some time in the bayou shooting. We used to shoot in fact, the name of this podcast, The Outdoor Journal, it started out life as a television program that Pete and I used to produce. And we shot an episode way back in the bayou with a bunch of boys that lived back there.
Louisiana gator hunters.
And every day we'd get up and go out and hunt gators with them. And oh, my
the
God.
Guys, you know, the guys, they have the overalls on with no shirt on it. And just the overalls over there. It's a great look, for sure.
Only certain people can pull off that look.
Kidding. Right. You know, and especially when they're holding a gun in one hand and a beer in the other. That's when they can really pull it off.
That's exactly these guys were a different breed altogether.
My God, they're cockroaches in their building were 2 to 3 inches long. They come out.
We could have been hunting cockroaches down there, and it would have been a great hunt.
This would be a good story for your book, Ryder. I'll tell you that. But that's just that one trip.
I'm already thinking of the next volume. We got to get those stories in the next
one. Sure.
Crazy.
Oh, man, it was nuts. And the snoring. Holy shit.
Oh my God.
That was horrible.
That was not snoring. We've since
that was decided
roaring. That was not
like
snoring.
Like lions in Africa. Oh God. Anyway, sorry.
But yeah, there's some great, great adventures out there in the world for sure.
What about this one, a guide in the donkey story? You got to tell us that one.
Oh man, that's such a classic. That's Mark Condit. And you know, the Condits, the old Condit stories, those really were the first stories that I said, holy cow, I got to write this stuff down. Like, I got to remember this stuff. And, you know, Mark's father, Win Condit, is one of the true legends of Western outfitting in the United States. And this was back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, a different time. And he was one of the early guys to explore parts of far northern Alaska for new areas to hunt moose and bear. And he would fly up there in a single engine Piper Cub, and his buddy Eddie King would fly his own plane. And they did that so that if one of them crashed, the other guy would have a chance to rescue the one who crashed. And they went so far north into Canada eventually they started crossing the peninsula. And to get back, you know, they would follow the coast. And Win Condit befriended the Inuit and would stay in the villages, and they would hunt seal and walrus with the Inuit on the way back down. And these are all Outdoor Life magazine stories from the 40s and 50s. And anyways, that, you know, his son, Mark Condit, and I have become great friends. And Mark, you know, they don't make him like Mark Condit anymore. He is an absolute cowboy. He's a real cowboy. And he, one night in a bar in Ten Sleep, Wyoming, he told me about the night that he, used to ride a mule when he would pack his elk hunting trips, you know, in the bighorns in Wyoming. He always used a mule, and he would ride a mule while the other guys were on a horse. And he said, Ryder, one night, you know, I was sitting, and it might've been in that same saloon. He said, one night I was sitting at the bar and bragging, I had too much to drink, and I was bragging that, hell, I'll ride this mule right into the bar. And, you know, and you guys can see how, you know, good I can control this mule. And of course the locals at the bar were telling him to, you know, forget you, pal, get out of here. Well, darn it, if he didn't walk out of the bar and hop on his mule and he rode the mule right back into the bar, right past the folks sitting at the bar, out onto the dance floor. And he spun it around, and this is him, you know, and this is, I've heard the story. You talk about, you know, can you double check the accuracy? And no question about it, these stories expand over the years, but I've heard this one actually told by a couple folks. He spun that, his mule, around the dance floor a couple times. And what nobody knew was that below the dance floor was a sunken cellar where they stored supplies for the bar. Mule busted through the dance floor, fell down into the cellar. With Mark still on the back of the mule.
Oh my God.
They still tell that story in Ten Sleep. And that, I mean, that's just one of endless, you can't make this stuff up. It's life as a cowboy in wild Wyoming. And it's great. It's classic stories.
God,
those little towns are just magic.
Aren't they? Yeah.
When you're fortunate enough to see them, they're just just a story waiting to be written in each one of them.
Story waiting to be written for sure.
Yeah. Well, the book is fascinating. I urge folks, if you want to just, you know, lose yourself in some great storytelling, and some of the stuff, like Ryder keeps saying, you can't make this stuff up.
Exactly.
I highly encourage folks to search it out. I'm assuming it's available on, if they go to Amazon, they'll find the book.
Oh, no doubt. You know, if you go to Amazon and Ryder Knowlton, R-I-D-R, and the guides, you can find it right on Amazon, super easy.
Before I let you go, you had an encounter with one of our podcasters, although he wasn't a podcaster at the time, on the Ottawa River. You employed the services of a Jamie Pistilli. Did you not at some point?
Jamie's, oh man, talk about just hitting it off as buddies. Jamie and I hit it off immediately. And I'll tell you, what brought Jamie and I together was my failure as a musky fly fisherman.
Oh boy.
Because, I've caught them on plugs, but I've never landed one on a fly. And being from North Carolina, you know, that area, you know, you get into that southern range of some really interesting northern species, including the musky and the rough grouse and even the native brook trouts. That's kind of the lowest end of their native range. And so I've spent many years on some of these great destination rivers of Virginia, Kentucky. You know, you get up in a Cave Run Lake, you know, legitimate musky destinations, at least for us in the U.S.
Yeah.
And I have yet to put one of those suckers in the boat on a fly. And to me, it's kind of like the permit, you know, in the world of saltwater fishing, you know, as a permit fisherman, which I am, I understand that it's a journey. And musky fishing on fly is a journey. It's not a fishing trip. It's a journey. And I'm about, you know, 8,500 casts into my 10,000 casts for my muskie. And I was reading about places to go, and we've got friends, you know, up around Ottawa. And I started reading about the Ottawa River system and learned that it is not only a place where you can go muskie fishing, but it's a world-class muskie fishery. Mm-hmm. And I kind of said, holy cow, this is fantastic. And did some, I do a lot of research on guides, tons and tons of research. And, you know, when somebody answers the phone and starts making promises about how big a fish you're going to catch, that's not the guide for me. Right. What I'm looking for is a guy that says, yeah, we've been having a decent year, but what you're going to do is experience the area, you know, and it's a good fishery and we'll see what happens. And of course that's Jamie. And so, yeah, we met, through my failure as a muskie fisherman, did some fantastic smallie fishing off the Ottawa. To this day, my best smallmouth ever on flies with Jamie, and we've been buddies ever since.
It's gotta be for a guide. It's gotta be one of the worst things you could ever hear. Oh yeah, by the way, I want to catch a muskie on a fly.
Like, you know,
the poor guys,
your chance of success has got to be less than
1%. It's already horrible with big stuff, no, with all this debate casting on those. I want to do it on a fly.
By the way, I was going to say you do a wonderful presentation on this format, just to let you know, and also let you know, Jamie is looking for a partner. You might want to.
Oh no, kidding!
You might want to call him up. He's got a podcast that he does on this network that he's looking for a partner for. I think you'd be perfect.
Perfect.
I think there it is.
So yeah. He's a guide. You're a guide user. What a great combination that would be.
That would be perfect.
Oh, there you go. And in the meantime, we can keep trying to get that muskie on fly together.
Good luck on that one. I'm a betting man, but I would not bet.
Betting man that Jamie's just going cha-ching, cha-ching. He keeps coming back. Thank you very much. Show me the money.
No question.
Ryder, thank you very much for, you're an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much. Hopefully one day we'll be able to share, a boat and
be fun.
Tell some stories together. I'm sure we'll have no shortage of those.
Well, I'd love to do it someday. And guys, it was an honor to be on your show. So thank you so much.
Thanks, buddy. Ryder Knowlton, a wonderful author. There's the book right there in front of you. I didn't notice until late that it was sitting right there in front of you,
right beside
covering
me.
You beside up. It's covering too. Up your beautiful Fishing Canada
beside
logo.
Me as well. Look.
Oh, beside you there. Yeah. I didn't even notice that.
Yeah.
Some of those stories in this book are just fantastic. And it brings back memories because and Pete wasn't kidding earlier on when he said we've talked about it forever, writing a book about our outdoor journal adventures for those 9 years as we traveled around the
world. We're not as smart as Ryder though. I mean, even we had our paperwork there, we had our boarding passes right there. That's for young people listening right now. If you were to start, you were to take a note of a writer's book of just writing it down on your boarding pass. Now you got a phone. You can just talk to your phone. Right? Just do it on a daily basis almost on trips. You might have a book in the making, you know, another 20 years.
And not necessarily as a book for sale, but as Ryder mentioned,
a diary.
Great way to pass down those stories to the next generation.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately, as things change in the outdoors, as more and more restrictions are imposed, maybe even to the point where some of these activities are going to be poo-pooed at some point. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to say, hey, here's a collection of journeys that I've had. Enjoy them.
So many times my dad and I had the discussion before he passed away. You know, he says, I should write a book. I says, you're damn right. You should write a book. And I'll be the one guy that buys it. Doesn't matter if anybody else says the story, because he tells me all the stories, but I know he had so many more in his mind. And they were just, I could hear those stories over and over again. Like to this day, he could still tell me those stories and I just love it. You know what I mean?
So if
you
sit there forever, listen to
him. Yeah.
Like a guy like that. You could imagine sitting around a campfire with him.
It'd be so much fun.
Craziness. Yep.
And not just the guide stories, his stories.
His stories.
All these trips he did. Sitting at a fishing destination, smoking cigars and drinking rum.
Oh, that's where I want to be right now. So bad. Once again, the book is called A Collection of Untold Stories. It's available everywhere. Go to Amazon. I'm sure they'll be more than happy to. I never asked them, how much does that cost? Anyways, do we know?
Does it have it in there?
I don't know.
I'm not looking.
Don't forget fishingcanada.com, the gateway, the portal to your next adventure.
New contests all the time. We got some new Garmin stuff going up right now as we speak. Beautiful. Again, oh my God.
Boats, motors, and trailers coming, folks. So
yeah,
this summer,
yes,
you don't want to miss that one.
Yeah, that's for sure.
That's it. On behalf of the entire crew here, Vova behind the camera today, as he usually is. Nick was even here today for a little bit.
Looking good.
Yeah, he was in and out. He was on his phone all day. But you know what? At least he's here. At least he's sitting here. And that's a big plus. Of course, Dean Taylor, our producer, as usual, on the board. On behalf of them and my co-host Peter Bowman, I'm Angelo Biola. Thanks for joining us. Talk to you next time.